The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go, we have with us Gary Evans. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Hi, and thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
And you're coming from us from the UK, correct?
That's right, yeah, just to the south of London.
All right. And you want to tell people what you're involved in as far as alternative archaeology goes?
Yeah, well, the brief version would be I'm an agent for a lot of the top alternative history and mystery authors. So I tend to meet a lot of authors and discuss the various mysteries of ancient sites around the world. And I'm also heavily involved with running conferences in the UK and the US, something that gets us like-minded souls together to discuss these subjects that many of us love. And also organize and host tours to ancient sites, because it's one thing discussing these things, but actually visiting these places and feeling the power that's quite often present, or the effect that it has on us. And so I kind of collaborate with people like Brian Forster, previous guest in Peru, do tours to Peru and Bolivia, work with people like Robert Bavau and the family connected to the Pyramid Code that was done by Carmen Bolter, Awiyan family that lived near the base of the Sphinx. And I've got an amazing lady that's sort of in the Stonehenge direction, Maria Wheatley, in the UK. So I'm really getting a good perspective across the world of these ancient sites, and there are many similarities.
And you work with the acoustic properties too, right?
I do. That's something that Egypt and my time there introduced me to. I wasn't aware of it before going to Egypt. And many of these ancient sites do definitely have acoustic properties. The Great Pyramid is probably the finest example of that, because it's so finely tuned. And we've had some amazing experiences inside. So yeah, there's plenty to share. And then once I was kind of, given the eyes or the ears to see this connection to ancient sites, I've seen similar things in Peru and in Guatemala, and also found something very similar in the Stonehenge landscape as well. So it does seem like a common pattern across these ancient places.
Now, how did you get into this? Were you always interested in this type of stuff?
It started off when I was sort of 17, and we had a few strange experiences, and I started to go to the local libraries and reading a lot of books, and I kind of had an inquiring mind, I guess, from a young age. And then I'd work in the corporate world and kind of lose interest for a while, but then I'd start going out to the libraries, obviously pre-internet. And then when the internet came along, it opened up a whole new kind of field of research. So yeah, I've had an ongoing interest for about 20 years now, and from spending time on location, it's just been very heartwarming to see these places that I thought were kind of dead or empty, didn't really have anything to offer people now. They've come to life before my eyes many times, so they're still really worth visiting, and not just for taking photographs.
Now, do you think these common acoustic properties and the energy of these sites, do you think this points to a common origin?
Well, that is a common point of discussion on the tours. And it does, it certainly looks like either the people were traveling, and there's more and more evidence coming out about navigable ocean-going vessels off the coast of Egypt. A lot of academics have released some information recently. So this kind of picture we have in our minds of no transoceanic contact, I don't think is the right one. So people were traveling back then just a bit slower than we are now, I think we can say. But there is also other ways of information to flow, which is what these ancient sites seem to speak about when you're getting into the kind of spiritual side. And if you can meditate and get into a kind of place of deep realization, so a kind of eternal wisdom. And it's quite possible that the shamans of native peoples could access a kind of that state of mind for these type of sites to be built, in my opinion.
Okay. So it's possible that instead of trading off information, they were just gathering information from the same sort of meditative source?
Well, from my experiences, I would say if we can get into a very deep state of meditation, we are able to connect into the, for want of a better term, the collective consciousness. And whereas on one level we all have our own truth, my truth might not actually be a kind of deep-seated real truth, but there is a deep-seated real truth in terms of how natural laws work and these kind of things. And I believe our ancestors were able to reach this point of realization, so they kind of knew some of the fundamentals that we've lost touch with, that underlie nature and energy and subtle energies, and the things that we've kind of bypassed because we like this instant gratification with our modern technology. But they had a lot more time and patience.
Yeah. Well, do you think our modern technology cuts us off from that as well?
Well, I think one example that I could give of that is if we're visiting an ancient site, more often than not, certainly a normal kind of tourist experience is to go with your cell phone or camera and stare into this very small screen and then take photographs of the ancient site. So that's what I would say the vast majority of people do when they're going to a temple in Egypt, for example, because we all want to have memories of our experience and things to share with our friends. But when I'm in my yoga class, one of the things that we're taught in yoga is that we want to be expanding our awareness. So rather than staring at this very small screen directly in front of us, we want to be expanding our awareness, so we've got a peripheral vision, so we're almost looking out kind of 180 degrees. So if you go into an ancient site with that approach, you tend to absorb a lot more of the surroundings and kind of get into this state of peace in your mind. So rather than thinking, oh, what am I going to take a photograph of next, you walk in, expand your awareness, and if you can get your mind to the still point, that's when you can kind of tune into these subtle energies, in my opinion.
Okay. I'm trying to think how to phrase the question. Do you think these sites were built specifically on power spots, or do you think that the sites themselves created these power spots?
Well, the sites were certainly built on power spots, a majority of the time, I would say. I think our ancestors just intuitively knew it was something that came natural to them, that there are these powerful places on the planet where there's sort of discontinuities in the geology, so you get these subtle energies that swell up to the surfaces. So one of the things that I think they would do is either harness or enhance this natural upswelling of energy. And one interesting example is that they have moved the island of Philae in Egypt. They flooded the original location, and so the level of the Nile rose up, so they had to uprooted the whole temple in the 60s, and they've moved it, and that location is still very powerful. Even though we've moved it in modern times. And so it does seem that on top of the either the ley lines or these sort of energy currents that are flowing through the planet, they had some way of locking energy into the blocks, because there's one granite block, and it, and crystal is the kind of common theme between the majority of these sites, and granite has a lot of crystal in it. And there's one block on the island of Philae that I've shown to many guests, and one of the guests on our tours said that she felt like she'd actually been plugged into the universe when her hands were on it. So that kind of power. And I mean, it's difficult to convey the kind of magnitude of the experiences over the internet if people haven't got any kind of context, because we can only understand something and we use our life experience to put some kind of context on it. So what I try to convey to people is ways that we can get a sense of these kind of experiences even close to home with a few techniques and changes to our lives. And then once you start kind of expanding into it, perhaps some of these ancient sites would start calling more.
Do you think these sites were primarily built to harness this energy, or do you think they may have had multiple purposes?
Well, another big part of the puzzle, I think, that comes into it is water. The geology where the Giza Plateau is, with limestone, and there's lots of water channels. I mean, there's so many channels underneath the Giza Plateau. I think the engineering that was involved might even be equal to putting up the Great Pyramid. It's quite a labyrinth, and I've crawled around in some of it. But that landscape is also very similar to the Stonehenge landscape, which is chalk, and that has a lot of running water, and Stonehenge is very close to a river. And when water runs through the chalk, it does generate a very faint electrical charge, which is the same thing you can say at the Giza Plateau. So we've got crystal, running water, and then we normally have large stones. And if there's a natural subtle energy in the area as well, you're kind of getting to a combination of things. And also the different pyramids, there could be some kind of connection between them. It certainly looks like they're connected under the ground. If we're starting to talk about acoustic resonance or energy fields of some sort, that's the kind of thing that we're thinking is, could be going on there.
Okay. But do you think that was the main reason they built them, or did they build them to store like the calculations and the alignments and just happen to also build them someplace that would generate energy? Or do you think the energy part was the primary thing and then they did the alignments with them?
I think that they served some kind of a practical purpose at the time, but also they looked at things in a holistic way. I've got one client, Walter Crutendon, that runs a conference, CPAC, about cycles of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite keen on that theory. So they may have even had an awareness of trouble ahead. And certainly, if you wanted to help your ancestors down the road, it would make sense to try and encode some information into the structures. And it does seem to be lots of mathematical information encoded into the Great Pyramid, and I don't think we've worked everything out yet. They're still a bit beyond us.
Well, we have to know the information in the first place to find it encoded into the pyramid.
Well, that's it. And our various sciences, I think, are actually slowly catching up to what some of the people seem to know in the distant past. Because if we're going under the assumption that we're the most intelligent that we've ever been, then we don't tend to look at these structures for any relevant information. But I feel that I've seen enough to know that they had a much better understanding of the natural world. And the acoustic properties in the Great Pyramid, which we could certainly talk at length, but there's no coincidence that there's these amazing acoustics inside. The whole chamber, which they're calling a tomb chamber, is massively over-engineered just to be a tomb chamber. In fact, they tried to call these chambers above the King's Chamber, which is the uppermost chamber, they call them relieving chambers, as if they're going to relieve pressure from this King's Chamber. But the King's Chamber is not even built into the walls of the pyramid. They've isolated it so that it can resonate at a stronger rate, is the only kind of logical conclusion. Because if you wanted to build the structure in the strongest way possible, you wouldn't have this room inside the Great Pyramid that's not built into the surrounding structure, because it weakens it.
So it's actually set so it has room to kind of vibrate slightly?
Yes, yeah, because the Great Pyramids, the majority of it's made out of limestone, and the King's Chamber is made out of these huge granite blocks weighing up to 80 tons that have been moved 500 miles, and the walls of the King's Chamber are not locked in into the limestone, so there is a small gap so that it can vibrate, it would appear.
Well, what do you think of Christopher Dunn's theory that it was a power plant at one point?
Well, I've just returned from co-hosting a tour with Chris Dunn, and he's certainly been a huge inspiration when I came across his work. It just made a lot of sense that instead of looking at the Great Pyramid as this kind of tomb, that I was looking at what we would call now some kind of a machine. It's just, it seems too big to be just serving the purpose of a tomb. That was my kind of logical thought. So I think he could well be right. Some kind of a device. I didn't actually get into the debate about the purpose of it while I was on location with him. And I'm certainly open to his insights. He's definitely, I think, helping to open our eyes about the precision of the ancient Egyptians. When he measures the statues and they're kind of millimeter perfect, when he cuts the face in half on a computer and overlaps one on over the other half of the face, I mean, the perfection there is incredible, something that we would need modern computers and lathes to reproduce. So if we're only giving the ancient Egyptians credit of eye coordination and copper chisels on these incredibly hard stones, it seems a bit of a stretch of the imagination.
So do you think they might have also had acoustic-based tools? Like, could they maybe have moved these blocks using sound and used, you know, tools that were sound-driven?
It's certainly possible. I think there was a very early record by Herodotus, I believe it was, although don't quote me on that. But I was reading about it, and the earliest report of how they were moving the stones was they would put this sheet of what he called paper down, and then hit one of the blocks with a metal tube. The block would move up over the paper and then drop down again, and then they would repeat the process. And it is these huge blocks with, again, crystal, which does vibrate, but they seem to be moving around. So they must have had some way of moving these huge blocks that is easy to them. Because why are they building out of blocks that weigh 2, 3? And I mean, there's the unfinished obelisk that's up to 1,000 tons. Wow. In Egypt. So what appears to be hard to us, we can move them just about with our massive cranes. They must have had a simpler way of moving it. And resonance, I think there does seem to be some clues in that direction.
Yeah, well, it seems like a lot of ancient cultures all have the stories of, like, some kind of sound technology being used here and there throughout their history.
Well, again, in Tibet now, I think there's some videos on YouTube of, and the kind of common denominator from what I've experienced in Egypt and what I've seen of these Tibetan monks is that it's people cooperating as a group. So we're then kind of getting into the terms of either consciousness, if we have some kind of latent psychic abilities that isn't capable of doing much by itself because we haven't developed it. But if we had a kind of basic understanding and then came together as a group, that perhaps we could do something with 10, 20, 50 people. And the sound is a similar method. I can do toning by myself and I can feel certain effects, but by coming into a group of people, that effect is definitely amplified, and then using that effect at some of these sites has produced some incredible results that surprise me. And that's what the Tibetan monks seem to be doing, using sound to levitate rocks. I mean, I've seen probably about 5 or 6 guys drumming and using various instruments and then probably chanting. And that kind of combined effort seems to produce some effects over the material world.
And that's totally beyond our understanding with current science.
Yeah, well, I don't know what they've done behind the scenes, but in terms of everyday knowledge of us cooperating as a group in that kind of way, it's definitely not generally known.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about the Great Pyramid.
Okay.
Now, what are some of the, you were talking about the relieving chambers and stuff, but what other kind of acoustic properties does it have?
Well, I think you've got a little clip that you can give people kind of taste of it with.
And okay. Can you explain what this is we're about to hear?
Yeah, well, so this is me toning inside the Great Pyramid. And what I would normally recommend is if you can listen to the clip on a kind of decent setup that's got some fairly big speakers and turn the bass up, what you'll hear after I finish toning is this kind of reverb effect. It's a feedback mechanism, and when you're inside, it just goes straight through your body, and it's quite an amazing feeling. So I've kind of called it a bit on one of my recordings. And I mean, I've learned about toning and different kinds of frequencies and the effects on my state of mind by spending quite a lot of time in the Great Pyramid. I've actually lost track of the amount of times I've been in there now, but it's probably close to 20. So I've had some real quality time in there, and by learning some lessons, I would call it, inside the Great Pyramid, and then using those lessons with groups of people and at the temples around Egypt and other ancient sites. This is a big part of some of the amazing experiences that we've shared. So it is something that I've learned that I can share with others, and then the people that I share it with tell me that they've had a sort of amazing insights and these deep connections, and it means a lot to them. And I've seen the joy in their eyes on a number of occasions, which is incredibly heartwarming.
Okay, well, let's hear this. This is just you then, right?
Yes, right, yes.
Okay, let's hear this clip. So that was interesting. What part of the Great Pyramid were you in?
That's actually inside the King's Chamber.
Okay, that's way up top.
Yes, that's the very most top chamber. And I mean, it's easiest way to get your bearings is just put Great Pyramid King's Chamber diagram or something into Google and have a look at an image. But you're going to go up about 300 feet. You climb up to get inside it once you've entered the Great Pyramid.
And there's really no way this could have been done on accident.
No, and it's not it's not just an isolated thing. I've definitely seen resonance other sites, and in fact we think it's tuned to F sharp, and various engineers have looked at these relieving chambers that I mentioned earlier, and whereas one side of basically it's made out of granite beams, and one side of the granite beam is smooth and the other side is rough, and so the kind of thinking is that they've tuned these beams to a certain frequency so that the whole structure resonates to F sharp by the looks of it, and it's just, yeah, it's just the most amazing room, and there's far too much detail, and in fact there's a shaft, the Grand Gallery, that's about 130 feet long that leads up to the King's Chamber, and there's a metal ladder at the bottom of the Grand Gallery, and it's so sensitive to sound, the whole structure, that I've heard someone's footstep on that metal ladder, and it's just picked the sound all the way up 130 feet through a small corridor into the King's Chamber. So the amplification of sound is incredible, and in fact you can hear the sound from outside the pyramid. When we were inside, one of our guests went outside and was laying on the Great Pyramid, and he said that he could feel the whole structure vibrating.
Hmm. All right. Now, wasn't we had a break apart part of the Grand Gallery, correct?
They've made a small hole in the top to get into these relieving chambers.
Oh, okay. So we could actually get into the King's Chamber without destroying any of the Grand Gallery?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct. They at the bottom of the Grand Gallery is the ascending passage, and it's at the bottom of that that they had to blast into so we could get access to the inside of the pyramid.
Okay. For some reason, I thought they destroyed some of the stone that was making up the Grand Gallery or something, or is that something else?
Not anything apart from a small hole in the top, which you access via a ladder to get over the top of the King's Chamber into the relieving chambers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
The only thing, because it's an integral part of the structure. I don't know what would happen if that was interfered with too much. It's a massive, I think it's about 30 feet high some places.
Okay. I don't know what I'm thinking. I thought there were parts that were blocked off that we actually broke through, but maybe I'm remembering wrong.
Yeah, I think that's what you're thinking of, the relieving chambers. They blasted through these various levels, which is coming off of the Grand Gallery.
That might be it. That very well might be it. So when you're in there and you're intoning like that, you said it goes right through you. Do you feel it actually affecting your consciousness, your state of mind?
Yes. And in fact, just walking into the Grand Gallery and going up to the great, the King's Chamber, you're already starting to feel a bit different, like you've left the normal reality behind. I mean, it affects different people in different ways. I'm particularly sensitive to these kind of things, so I pick it up quite often as one of the first in the group, and I've been working on increasing my sensitivity with yoga and meditation and time in nature, those kind of things, and my diet, and working with sound, and so I feel it very directly. But as soon as I explain my kind of process, you could say, of tuning in. And normally the biggest step is just to allow yourself the time to feel something. Like I was mentioning earlier, we're normally so busy going around taking photos or kind of thinking that we don't just sit quietly and feel what's present. And that applies to ancient sites as much as spending time outside in the natural world. But we all have this instinctive ability, I would argue. This is where we've come from. We've become disconnected from the natural world by and large, certainly those living in cities, but it is a part of us. And I think that the transformation of getting into this place of stillness can happen quite quickly for people once they give themselves a chance. And so, for example, in April, we had sort of between 20 to 25 of us in the King's Chamber. And I'd been talking a lot on the tour about sound and the effects on consciousness, and also the importance of group harmony, because the King's Chamber amplifies sound. You really want to be in harmony with each other, so it's not amplifying these kind of competing sounds. If you've got one sound and it amplifies that as a group, that's kind of where I feel it the most powerfully. So we'd had a few different practices that, because a lot of the pyramids have these acoustic features. The Great Pyramid isn't the only one. The Red Pyramid is also a favourite of mine. And we'd had some practice goes, and we had 2-hour private visit inside the Great Pyramid. And we were in the King's Chamber, a lot of us, for almost all of that time. And after about half an hour or so, we kind of got into this place of almost, you could say, one voice. We're all in harmony together. And I was just laying down in the middle of the King's Chamber with my back on the floor in a kind of star shape. And I just let go to see what I could feel. And I definitely seemed to reach this point of connecting to the collective consciousness. That's how it felt. And one of the guests wrote me a nice little piece about her experience, and she also experienced the same thing, as did many people. So it's not just kind of Gary going a bit crazy or imagining it. Which I'm open to that possibility, because I don't want to just leave myself off on the wrong track and then start trying to share things with others that aren't reality. But when you can have a joint experience with lots of people, and I can repeat it on different tours over time, so it's different groups of people, so I'm really starting to build up a picture of these experiences now. And I like to hear about different people's feelings. So it does give me a confidence to talk about it. I know it's something tangible. It is something that can be shared. And it's something that means a lot to me personally, and means a lot to those that have also felt this kind of feeling.
Can you go into a little bit of detail of what you experienced?
Well, on this particular occasion, one of the big things that happens when you're in that kind of state of mind is you let go a lot of your personality, the kind of ego side of it. So if you're kind of connecting to the collective consciousness, I would say that there is a small awareness of yourself, but also an awareness of everything that you're capable of perceiving. And it just seems like this massive ocean stretching out as far as you can see, or as far as you can feel. And quite often when I get into this space, I seem to be either given or feel some kind of deep epiphany about the areas that I'm researching in. And the main insight from this particular experience was that whoever made the Great Pyramid understood the power of sound. And we're talking about Om sound here. That kind of vibration is what we're using, which I think in some ways has been described as either the word of God or the sound of the universe. Well, the sound of the universe was kind of where this epiphany was going. And it was basically explaining that underneath the visible matter that we perceive as the physical world, that there is this vibration and this sound, which we're now aware of due to physics. We know that everything's not as solid as it appears. But there's this sound that permeates the universe, and I wasn't 100% sure if it was supposed to be an audible sound or it's something that's inaudible to us as humans. But nevertheless, there is this very faint vibration sound below the physical matter. And that whoever made the Great Pyramid was fully aware of this and tuned the King's Chamber to this frequency. And so I found that, yeah, very interesting. I didn't get the total picture on why they designed the Great Pyramid in that way, but nevertheless, that they were kind of steps ahead of our understanding, and also by harmonizing with that sound in the King's Chamber as we can today, you can get into this state of the collective consciousness, which is an amazing experience.
Now, by collective consciousness, you mean like sort of a feeling of unity?
Yes. Yeah, that would be one way of putting it. If we're as... I mean, I can only describe it as if we are all part of the universe, all looking at each other from different perspectives. In other words, the universe is trying to learn more about itself through all of these different incarnated people on the planet, which I think is a kind of general spiritual understanding. It's a bit of a leap of imagination for a lot of people to make, I understand that. And I've only got to it in the last few years from doing a lot of practice myself. But that's how I see it. So all of us incarnated here have the universe. We are part of the universe. And there's a higher aspect of ourselves that's somewhere on a different level of reality. And by having these kind of experiences, we are able to get ourselves back into that place where we're all connected, which can only have positive effects from what I can see, because a lot of the problems on the planet is that we think it's all about me, but on one level we are all connected, and we're all connected on this planet, so what one of us does to another does have a kind of a ripple effect.
Okay, well, we gotta take a quick break. We'll be right back with Gary Evans.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we're back on Where Did the Road Go with Gary Evans. And do you want to direct people to your website before we go any further?
Yeah, sure. So my main website with the sort of conferences and tours I organise is infinite-connections.co.uk. It's normally pretty easy to find me under Gary Evans Egypt. I'm on Facebook. I have an Infinite Connections group on Facebook, and on Twitter, connections_PR. So yeah, okay. The latest information about the Egypt tours and the other tours that I help organise, there's a few coming up later in the year that people are welcome to join or contact me about if they have any questions. We normally have a few different perspectives on the tours. I don't think mine's the only one. We like to work with different authors, and yeah, just sharing the information that we feel is relevant and can help each other along their various research paths.
What are some of the bigger ones you have coming up?
Well, one that I'm working on with Robert Bavall is in September, and that's quite an affordable 10 days in Egypt. And in October, I'm working on the Paradigm Symposium, which is a big conference in Minneapolis that has a lot of top authors. Robert Bavall will be there as well. Dr. Robert Schock and about 18 other speakers. So that website's worth checking out. I'll be there. May well end up giving a talk. And then we've got a kind of spiritually themed tour in December that I'm going to be co-hosting. And that's going to delve into some of these experiences in a deeper way, and just share with people as they need, because we all need different things. And I'm quite used to kind of adapting to different groups of people. We have big tours and big tour groups and small tour groups. So yeah, just really, I've tried to put tours together with my clients and friends, because I'm aware that many people do feel called to these ancient sites. I didn't know why I felt called in the first place. And I do feel that I'm learning more about myself, and possibly as a result, most sort of everybody else, certainly learning a lot more about empathy. And it's really helped move my understanding forwards in a positive way. So if I can share that with others, I really do take that as a sacred responsibility.
Okay. Don't you have another website as well?
There's also my AtlantisEvidence.com website, which discusses a lot of the big questions that I had over these ancient sites. Why our version of history as we know it doesn't seem to match the evidence around the planet. And a site in Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, is the kind of smoking gun for that, which they've now carbon dated to sort of 10 to 12,000 years ago, and seems to show that when they thought we were hunter and gatherers, that in fact we had organized societies and we were constructing buildings even back then, which does change the timeline of human history somewhat. And there also seems to be evidence that the Sphinx in Egypt is much older. That's a geological evidence from Dr. Robert Schock. A lot of people may be aware of his work. So
we've had him on a couple of times, actually.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And a very nice guy. I've got a lot of time for Robert. Enjoy meeting him and his wife. So that's the main two websites. And I really just put Atlantis Evidence together because I had a lot of time to research these ancient mysteries. And I thought, well, if anybody's coming along, that perhaps I could at least put my research in one place to give them a head start from what I had.
Okay, and what do you think Atlantis was?
Well, I've done a lot with Graham Hancock, and I'm certainly thinking along his lines, which is a global maritime civilization rather than just an island that disappeared under the waves. And it certainly does appear that high knowledge just popped up in Egypt. There doesn't seem to be any kind of development stage in the archaeological record. So some people, group of people, we don't know how many, at some point arrived in Egypt with a high level of knowledge, and in a relatively short space of time, they were building amazing structures like the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, and it seems like that's common for almost every culture around the world. They just kind of popped into existence and then declined from that point.
And because I think there's certainly been a series of cataclysms on this planet, which is why we've definitely lost touch with ourselves and our history. And so they can only trace it back to 4000 BC. They tell us in Sumeria, but then, I mean, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey has only been discovered, I think it's sort of the last 15 years or so, and it's only relatively recently it's come to the world's attention, and that's the one that really is going to push the dates back. But things take a little while to change in archaeology, and they probably want to find a bit more context for the site before they start rewriting all of our school history books. But there is evidence there, and for people that find a show like this with an open mind, there's definitely some real tangible mysteries, and I've just been really glad that I've had an opportunity to visit a number of these sites and see things that I'd never imagined were possible. I mean, throughout Egypt, there's evidence of crystal buildings, and they were using crystal, probably in combination. I mean, pure crystal, calcite and alabaster. My friends in Egypt showed me evidence near the second pyramid, the Khafre pyramid, of either a crystal temple or perhaps a small crystal pyramid. And it was just built out of white crystal. And so I went back and had a look, and I could definitely trace the outlines of this crystalline building, and there was a huge block of crystal left, and I tapped it, and it had this resonant effect. It hummed. And I videoed that. So it is there on the ground, but somebody needs to come along and piece these pieces together rather than just ignoring them, because they're just so odd from a normal perspective.
How big would that building have been, do you think?
I actually counted my paces walking across it. I think it was about 20 paces across and 40 or 50 in length.
So big, but not huge.
Yeah, pretty big. And also the temple floor in front of the Sphinx is also crystal.
Really?
And so, yeah, there's definitely some strange things in Egypt. And I mean, in one of my presentations, I go into what they might have been doing with these kind of crystal basins that are at a site called Abu Ghraib, because there's these huge round crystal basins that have a very smooth round hole cut into them that would seem to suggest water was flowing through them. And I think that could have been a way to charge water energetically. And water's that's a huge subject that we have a very basic understanding. I think the work of Dr. Emoto has really captured people's attention, if you're aware of his work.
He's the one that was able to impress emotions on water and change its structure.
And then freeze it so that you could see the sort of difference between love and hate, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. He's definitely captured a huge part of the world's attention with that research, because I think on some level we instinctively know these things. Because we're basically a flesh body around water. So vessels are containing water, we're 70 to 80% water. And I think there is going to be more research done on the understanding of the connection between consciousness and the water in our bodies, if I had to guess. I think that's what some of the evidence in Egypt has certainly made me think about.
Now, have you ever been to Göbekli Tepe?
I haven't. That is one remaining on my list.
Now, what other sites have you found some of these acoustic properties at that are similar to the pyramid?
Well, once I was, given the eyes or the ears to see these acoustic properties, I went over to Peru with Brian Falser, and we did a little tour together, and I found an amazing site there that he took me to called Moray, which is M-O-R-A-Y, Moray in Peru, and it's these huge circular structures that have been cut into the peaks of the Andes. I mean, you've got snow-capped mountains all around you, and you drive up, and I guess it's at about 9,500, 10,000 feet, something like that, and that site has incredible acoustics, and so I had quite a moving experience there, and that site seemed to be more of a feminine site, because the resonance of the structure was just at the edge of my vocal range, and in fact I strained my throat, but it had this a very good amplification effect. So it's worth looking up Murray on Google Images, and there's a few shots of it from the air that really give you a sense of the structure. And it's something that I've looked at with Brian Forster, and Brian and I were thinking about it, and he went back and had a look at the site, and it actually looks like they've sculpted the whole of the mountainside with this kind of curvature that matches these circular structures. And if that's so, I mean, the amount of work involved is mind-boggling. So I've seen acoustics in Peru. I went to Central America, various places in Guatemala, Tikal, which has got the sort of very well-known Mayan pyramids, where they filmed the scene at the end of the first Star Wars, with these kind of pyramid tops sticking out of the forest. And that's an amazing place, well worth visiting. And
those pyramids also have the those are the ones that you can clap at the bottom and hear the sound of the bird sacred to Quetzalcoatl at the top.
Well, that's what I was about to say. Yeah, because the tourist guides, you hear them clapping their hands. And so they think it's the sound of a bird. But you clap your hands at the base of the pyramid, and the sound hits the pyramid, and it's then transformed into this other sound that bounces back to you.
Do we even know how they did that?
No. No, I couldn't get any decent answers on it. It must be, because it was kind of bouncing off the bottom of the steps is how I was feeling it when I was doing it. But of course, the archaeologists, if they're just looking at it through their sort of traditional mindset, it's some kind of a religious practice. They revered the local bird, so they want to imitate it. I mean, that's the kind of train of thought that we normally hear. But when I was there, I was walking towards the pyramid, and then all of a sudden my kind of instincts took over, and I started clapping my hands faster and faster and faster, and the sound was going, it was like a womp, 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 womp. When I was clap, 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 it was like womp, 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 womp. And I could feel this sound hitting me, and I actually just kind of did it very instinctively, and it surprised me, and I was just kind of went into this motion of just clapping my hands and walking towards the sound, and it was getting louder and louder. And then all of a sudden I kind of snapped back to my normal logical, hopefully, thinking. And so that kind of took me by surprise, and I also did some toning on the top of a few of the pyramids there, and many of them were way off the tourist trail that we went out to, mosquito infested place.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, would you say your experiences toning in these places were similar to the Great Pyramid or different?
Very different. I think what the pyramids in Guatemala were telling me about this, when the sound, I can hear the sound transforming into something else. It was, I think the message was that by using sound at these sacred sites, we can transform ourselves as well. That was kind of what I got from it, because it does have a very subtle internal effect, and by repeated use, we can definitely see a noticeable benefit. And sound healing is the general area that we're talking about when we're talking about these sites. So if there's anyone listening that's interested in this subject, it's quite easy for a lot of us to go along and sample something similar, because there's something called gong baths, which is the huge kind of brass gongs. There's a lot of sound healing events across the US and Europe now with gongs, so that's one to try. And normally they will play this certain vibration to you, and you'll be laying down for an hour. And the feeling at the end of the hour is quite amazing. You just feel very light and kind of have this tingling sensation on your skin. So that's one way people can test this. Crystal bowl healing is another method. And when I first heard about that, I didn't get it. I thought, well, that's kind of woo-woo sort of thing.
Right. Well, it's been so thoroughly marginalized by the media, you know, the very idea of the gypsy with the crystal ball, and it's all a bunch of hokey nonsense. And
ball. Not ball.
Huh?
Ball, as in B-O-W-L.
Oh, okay, okay.
And if you get a decent-sized crystal ball, and I've been doing it to a few people recently because I've purchased one, you can actually feel this sound vibration coming off of the ball. And they're tuned to different frequencies, but it is a nice feeling. When the sound interacts with your body, it feels good. And I've had some very nice feedback on the sound of crystal bowls. And what you can do with the gongs and the bowls is play multiple ones at once. And then you kind of get this combination of different sound frequencies hitting your body. So that would be my advice if anybody's interested in this topic, just to try and find something like that locally and give it a try. Because it is very easy to dismiss things without trying because they sound a bit wacky. But by trying some things that I thought were wacky, I've been very pleasantly surprised, is what I can say.
Yeah, well, I think because we live in such a materialistic culture that we don't, you know, that type of stuff has been marginalized so completely that people just dismiss it out of hand.
Yes, which is, well, I mean, it's different people need different things, so I don't do judgment, but just try to keep an open mind, I think, is my advice, and if you do feel inclined to try something like this, then, yeah, give it a try and just see what you think and make your mind up that way, but dismissing something as impossible before trying it might be doing you a disservice, I think I would say.
Oh, I would agree. At least give it a chance.
Yeah. Yeah, and just, yeah, see what you think. And me, you might be pleasantly surprised with the results. And so those kind of effects from those basic examples are kind of a sample of what's possible inside the Great Pyramid. But I'm also a huge fan of Sanskrit mantras, and I've done sort of Kundalini yoga and things, and from my research into that area, it does seem that whoever was in sort of northern India and Tibet had an understanding of repetitive breathing and the effects of sound on our subconscious, and so using sound in that way you can release emotional blockages, which I think is one that a lot of us could do with a bit of help with. The heart tends to hold on to things. Haven't quite worked out why that is, but certainly holds on to emotional trauma, romantic upsets, that kind of thing, and we can work through some of these things using sound, and as a result become kind of expanded compared to our older self. That's certainly how I've felt it, and mantras definitely work very nicely for me. The repetition of these various Sanskrit mantras, I would say, are definitely another way of subtle effects of sound helping our spiritual development.
And it seems like, you know, like with Graham Hancock's work in Supernatural and stuff, where he talks about the uses of ayahuasca and other drugs like that throughout the world, and then you have all these sound elements in these different sites, that this was a very major part of the life of these people.
Well, if we're looking at ourselves as spiritual beings having a physical experience, then if we look at it through those eyes, it makes sense that this would be something that's fundamental to your culture, that you know that you incarnate on the planet Earth, you've come here to perhaps learn certain lessons or help others grow, and or probably both, and so you would want to try and move that process as long as best you can. If we look at it through the kind of Western eyes, that we're a physical body, consciousness is generated by our heads, we have one life, we are here to procreate and earn some money, and that's it, then from that perspective, these kind of subjects do seem irrelevant. I'll give it that. But I think the people that are probably listening to this show, and it's becoming more widely accepted that there is more to life than we thought, and that by exploring these subjects and researching the areas that do interest us, life gets a lot more interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. You said you had been in some sites in England too, around Stonehenge, that had some acoustic properties?
Yes, yeah, in fact I found one site which was very aptly named the Devil's Den by somebody. Clearly sounds like they wanted to put people off going there. And my friend Maria has been taking people there for a long time. Took me to this site, and it's sort of 20 miles north of Stonehenge near Avebury, which is credited as the world's largest stone circle. And at this site, it's called a dolmen. So it's two standing stones with a standing stone over the top. And in this stone that was over the top of the two stones, I looked at it and it seemed to have a hole the size of my head. And it didn't go all the way through to the other side of the stone. It was just a kind of head-shaped hole that went partly inside. And I said to Maria, "Oh, look, there's a hole there. I wonder if I can put my head inside there." And I had a hooded top on because it was obviously going to be pretty dirty. So I pulled my hood up, and when I put my head in, it kind of made me think of the helmet thing that used to expand out of the wall in Stargate and wrap around their heads and download information.
Yeah.
That was the kind of thing that it felt like, because I put my head in it and my head went in and it was just below my chin. So kind of perfect head size, but I'm surrounded. I mean, it's only about an inch around my head spare. And so, of course, I had to tone. Again, it's a crystalline stone. I believe it was sandstone. And we could see the crystal in it. And so I did my toning that I do in Egypt and immediately could feel the whole of this megalithic stone, which was sort of 10 foot across by, I guess, 7 or 8 foot wide. And the whole thing did start to vibrate very subtly. So I did this for a while, and my friend Maria said that she could feel a kind of a change around her, and in fact she felt that she started to see various colours appearing in her vision. But the main thing that I normally say to people is, when you approach one of these kind of sites, is as you walk up, just sort of check in with yourself, see how you're feeling, what's your kind of state of mind as you approach the site. And then if we have one of these kind of experiences, as you walk away from the site, check in with yourself again and see how you feel. Do you feel different? And many sensitive people will probably say that they do feel different. These places are capable of having a subtle effect. And normally I feel kind of much more lighthearted. Have more energy flowing, definitely happier than when I entered, and that's really can never be a bad thing.
Although you have to admit, number of bad stories probably started with, "Can I put my head in there?"
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of ways to go with that one, isn't there? Thank God it wasn't an oven.
Or it didn't get stuck.
Yeah.
That would be a great story of a completely different type.
Yeah, I've done that.
So how much do you think you've changed since before you started doing this to now?
Well, because I do a lot of different things, it's a combination of factors. Like I was saying, I mean, if I go back to 2009, which was really where I got very low, I tried to fit into the kind of corporate world, and for one reason or another, a company closing or something going wrong, I always seem to get kicked out of the corporate world, even though I gave it my best shot. And I really wanted to help people. I was starting to have this feeling of I wanted to do something that had a positive effect. And if it wasn't helping people, I was going to try and go into something with animals. And so I got to a very low point in my life, because it's like, I want to find a passion. I want to find something that I love to do that's sustainable and I can continue doing it, rather than this sort of stop-start that I was doing in the corporate world. And so I went to yoga, and then I started to change my diet, got much more into raw food, had a friend that introduced me to green juice, which I highly recommend to people. Juicing's definitely a great thing to do. And so you're kind of starting to look at food in terms of the life force that it contains, the energy, whereas obviously a lot of processed foods or heavily cooked foods, there's not going to be a huge amount of life force in those. The real benefit that your body's looking for from eating something is the energy coming from the sun that's changed into plants and of course animals as well, and then we consume that and our body takes that life force for energy. So that was another big step, and gradually quietening my mind so that I could hear my intuition, which we've all got a very quiet voice again that quite often we ignore, and then visiting the ancient sites. So there's been a combination of factors, but I think I can say more than anything, my time in Egypt in the temples and the pyramids has put me in touch with a greater aspect of myself that I never knew existed. And so I'm very, very grateful for the time that I've spent there.
All right. And you want to go over the tour you have coming up again in September?
Yeah, well, September, I'm helping Robert with a tour to Egypt. I'm not sure if I'm going to be on that one yet. And that's going to be a 10-day tour. My next tour that I'm co-hosting to Egypt is in December. I've got the itinerary on my infinite-connections.co.uk website. So that's there, and that gives people a general feeling of the layout. We basically cover the whole length of the Nile, and if anyone is interested and able to go, feel free to drop me a line and I'll answer any questions you may have, because I know that these tours are quite often out of the reach of everybody, which is why I also do try and encourage people to use the practices that I've been discussing in nature. I mean, spending time by the ocean or in woods or just on the grass in your backyard. And another big point that I didn't mention is bare feet on the ground. If you want to connect to the world around you, bare feet on the grass or the sand is a very good way of doing that. And there has been some medical research coming out. There's papers you can find online about the benefits of grounding. I think they're kind of saying that these sort of free radicals that move around our bodies are able to be sort of balanced out a bit if we have our bare feet on the ground. So that's kind of encouraging. But after you've been doing it for a while, it just feels good. I'm addicted to my bare feet on the ground now.
Okay, and how much of an effect do you think all the electromagnetic signals from our technology have on us?
They do have an effect, unfortunately. Wi-Fi, I mean, there's about 10 or 12 that hit my house here from the surrounding houses and things, and it's not good. I have a client that's got her own property. She's got 250 acres. She turns the Wi-Fi... The Wi-Fi doesn't actually penetrate through older buildings. If you have thick walls, Wi-Fi signals don't penetrate. So I have a room there that I can use that there's no Wi-Fi hitting, and I get the best night's sleep. I sleep there like I used to sleep when I was 10 or 15, but I very rarely have. these days. So I know as soon as I go there, I'm going to get a much better sleep because there's hardly any electromagnetic pollution. So that's the biggest thing I've noticed from that.
Do you think it adds to sort of the feeling of disconnection in our culture?
Yes. I do think our bodies are able to adapt more than we're aware of. We're not in some kind, our bodies are not a fixed system, and the planet is able to adapt a bit slowly to human behavior. But time away from computers and cell phones and Wi-Fi things, I mean, we're really getting hit from all angles now with this modern technology. And it is, on some levels, it's helping us to connect. We're able to do things like this today that wasn't possible 15, 20 years ago. But I think it's important not to lose focus of these are tools that we can use some of the time, but not to lose ourselves in. I think that's the danger that they represent. We become completely disconnected and isolated and alone at home. But the reason that I like the tours and I also organise the conferences is because open-minded, like-minded souls enjoy each other's company. It's very empowering. So that would be my two cents.
All right. What's the conference you're working with here in the US?
Well, that was the Paradigm Symposium in October. And, yeah.
That's where?
That's in Minneapolis.
Okay.
Yeah.
And infinite-connections.com is your website.
.co.uk.
Oh, .co.uk, right.
Yeah.
And AtlantisEvidence?
.com.
.com, all right. Knew there was a .com there somewhere.
Yeah, sorry about that.
And people can also just search for you by putting in Gary Evans in Egypt, correct?
Yeah, that seems to find me pretty well. Gary Evans, Egypt, Infinite. And so I do a lot on Facebook. I'm just trying to share a greater awareness, really, and get people to perhaps just have a think about some of these subjects, and I'm sure they will resonate at varying degrees with different people listening. Hopefully I've given people something worth their time.
I think you have. All right. Do you have a YouTube? You said you had some videos.
My YouTube channel is a work in progress at this time. The videos I mentioned were in the presentations that I normally give at conferences.
Yes.
But yeah, I'm going to try and get something up there perhaps in the next 2 to 4 months because I would like people to see some of these footage I've been filming on site.
Awesome. All right. Well, I thank you for talking to us tonight. And maybe we'll have you back on sometime in the next few months so you can tell us some more stuff.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And yeah, and appreciate the invite. Thanks for listening, everyone.
All right, Last Exit for the Lost is up next. We're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. Come in, do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection, 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144.
into the heart of the universe. Ventricles and atria, chambers number 1597. And counting. And counting. Can you hear?